Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
There's a twin mattress just laying on the floor. There's a video camera that is set up on a tripod, and then there's like a little lamp.
This is what we call a dungeon.
Hi, I'm Yardley Smith. Guess what? Season 12 of Small Town Dicks is here.
She says, I've never been more terrified in a room with a patient before as I am with this man here.
I say, if you keep me on based on what I saw out there at the crime scene, I'm going to turn into a defense witness.
The hair on the back of my neck was standing up.
Small Town Dicks Season 12 is out now. Don't miss it.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 23rd of May, these are our main stories. The Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, addresses a huge rally in the Australian city of Sydney. The Sudanese capital, Khartoum, is reported to be relatively calm at the start of a week-long ceasefire. Russia says insurgents who launched attacks in the Bielgorod region on the border with Ukraine have been defeated. Also in this podcast...
Not all Republicans agree, however, that this is a fight Mr. DeSantis should be waging.
The problem is you're going to get to a place where people that are gay and conservative like myself, I can't defend it.
The latest from Florida on a falling out between the soon-to-be presidential candidate, Ron DeSantis, and the state's biggest private employer, Disney. Australia has given the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi a rockstar welcome as it tries to woo the world's most populous market and a powerful ally at a time of growing concern about China's military and economic might. Thousands of people, mostly from the Indian diaspora, attended a campaign-style rally in an arena in Sydney. Standing alongside the Indian Prime Minister, his Australian counterpart, Anthony Albanese, heaped praise on Mr. Modi.
I have met the Prime Minister, my friend, 6 times. But absolutely nothing beats standing with him on a stage like this, looking out at this magnificent sea of faces. What an honour. And what a joy it is to get to welcome Prime Minister Modi here with all of you.
Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, told us more about the lavish welcome Mr. Modi had received.
Before his speech at Sydney Olympic Park, Mr. Modi was mixing with celebrities and influencers. Above the skies of Sydney, there was a skywriting message saying, "Welcome, Modi." So for many members of the Indian diaspora in Australia, this is a very big moment. He was feted by thousands of people inside the event venue and had a pretty easygoing charm about him. He said that the people inside the auditorium shared his ambitions for India to be a developed country, and he said that India was a force for global good. So in many respects, Mr. Modi was preaching to the converted here in Sydney, and also remember that his speech would have been followed by many Indians back home as well. So this was very much a domestic event as much as an international one.
And Australia seeing India very much as a counterweight to China's growing military, diplomatic and economic clout.
Well, academics we've been speaking to in the last day or two believe that powerful geopolitical forces are pushing Australia and India closer together. They believe that closer defence and security arrangements between New Delhi and Canberra are an attempt to balance or counter China's growing influence in the region. So this is a very important visit in that regard. It's also worth noting, too, that not all members of the Indian diaspora are in favour of Mr. Modi's visit. Riot police outside the event in Sydney were called in to quell tensions between supporters of the Indian Prime Minister and also Sikh activists and other campaigners argue that Mr. Modi must have to answer for alleged human rights breaches in his country. So this is an event, this is a visit that really highlights the polarizing nature of India's long-serving Prime Minister.
And he's also hoping to capitalize on this back home.
He certainly is. It's important to note that the Indian diaspora, not just here in Australia, are very important politically for Mr. Modi. They raise money for his election campaigns, and they also provide the skills to boost messages at election time as well. So that's one reason why Mr. Modi, during his long address here in Sydney tonight, was calling the audience members friends. So he certainly was enthralling them with his oratory skills. And tomorrow he gets down to diplomatic business with formal talks with his Australian counterpart, Anthony Albanese.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. It got off to a shaky start, but the latest ceasefire in Sudan, intended to allow the delivery of humanitarian aid, seems to be holding. Witnesses in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, reported airstrikes and clashes in the hours after the ceasefire took effect on Monday night. But as we record this podcast on Tuesday afternoon, the situation is said to be calmer. The seven-day ceasefire is just the latest in a series of truces in the past 6 weeks, which up until now have failed to halt the conflict, which has claimed hundreds of lives. The head of the army and the leader of a rival paramilitary group are locked in a power struggle, and so far they've resisted international pressure to stop fighting. Mo Fadul, a resident of Khartoum, described the situation after the ceasefire came into effect.
Overnight, a few minutes into the ceasefire, I could hear two clear, heavy airstrikes not far from here. The house shook where I'm staying. Heavy airstrikes reported to the west of Khartoum, where the airbase is, the main military airbase. This morning, till about 4, skirmishes here and there could also be heard not far from here. But this morning, it's quiet, apart from the, I think it's a reconnaissance airplane that is going around in circles.
Our correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, who's monitoring the situation from Nairobi, gave us this update.
It is quiet now in the capital. We spoke to a resident in East Khartoum who said there had been no airstrikes this morning or fighting. However, she said in her neighborhood there was intimidation from RSF militiamen that they were wandering around the neighborhood shooting in the air, killing dogs for some reason, she said. We don't know why. And they're drunk. So people are not venturing outside. They're still stuck in their houses for fear of what it might mean to run into these RSF soldiers. So it sounds sort of chaotic and disorderly, but at least the fighting is not continuing between the two sides. And there is hope, certainly from the mediators and from the humanitarian agencies, that the calm will last long enough to be able to get essential humanitarian aid into the city. As we've reported before, there is a mechanism this time to monitor the ceasefire, which includes parties, both parties, as well as representatives from both mediators, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. So there's the plan is to look into any complaints of violations of the ceasefire and try to resolve disputes, and also to help coordinate with the humanitarian agencies.
And what are their priorities going to be? Because we have been reporting for weeks on how dreadful the situation is for people trapped in the middle of the fighting.
I think one of the key priorities is going to be the healthcare system. Medics have been reporting for some time now that it's basically on the verge of collapse. We've had the statistic from the doctors' union, the Sudanese doctors' union, saying that only 29 hospitals are operational throughout the country and not at full capacity. And in Khartoum, in the capital, only 6. So that's a real area of priority. There's also going to be, of course, efforts to bring in food because supplies have run low. flow, and especially to get essential services up and running again, because there's only sporadic access to water and electricity in parts of Khartoum. So those would be the priorities in the capital, but there's also been quite a lot of fighting in the western region of Darfur, where the RSF soldiers and their Arab militia allies have been reported to pretty much been burning and looting at will, with a lot of supplies, again, either stolen or destroyed. So that will also be a focus, I think, of aid groups, although it may be more complicated to help there.
Barbara Plett-Usher. To the U.S. now, and the state of Florida, where the Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, is expected to announce his run to become the party's presidential candidate in 2024, taking on the current frontrunner, Donald Trump. But Mr. DeSantis has picked a fight with another fellow famous Floridian resident, Disney, over the company's stance on a Florida bill restricting the ability to speak about gender identity in public schools, otherwise known as Don't Say Gay. The battle has escalated into an all-out war, with the governor removing Disney's ability to self-regulate its business interests in the state and the company filing a lawsuit for harassment in federal court. From Orlando, the home of the Walt Disney World, Anthony Zerker reports.
There's a fireworks display every night here in the Magic Kingdom, a tightly choreographed spectacle of sound and lights.
You have companies like a Disney.
But it's the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' battle with the Disney Corporation and its CEO Bob Iger that is stealing the show in the Sunshine State.
The governor got very angry about the position Disney took, and it seems like he's decided to retaliate against us.
You look at this whole special district. Walt Disney Corporation obviously owns a lot of it. What should we do with this land? Someone even said, like, maybe you need another state prison. Who knows?
Mr. DeSantis is about to announce a run for president, and he has framed himself as a champion of conservative social issues.
Florida is where woke goes to die.
But in punishing Disney for their outspoken opposition to state policies about what schools can teach about sexuality, he has picked the state's largest private employer as an opponent. And it's a fight that carries a serious political risk.
Sorry, it's so hot. When it came last week, it was like 2 degrees cooler.
Oh. Karen Huntley is the Republican chair of Orange County. That's where Disney World sits. I met her in the neighboring town of Winter Park, a quaint community full of small businesses that Ms. Huntley says cares more about the cost of living than the governor's battle with the House of Mouse. But even she says the public nature of the fight caught her off guard.
I was surprised. I think it seemed like it was just a couple top executives making some decisions, and then it just turned into a giant snowball.
Has there been a political cost?
I don't think so. I don't think anyone thought it would be this big of a deal, but the bottom line is people want their kids to be educated in school. If the governor didn't hold the line on that, I think he wouldn't have been as successful in his reelection campaign.
Not all Republicans agree, however, that this is a fight Mr. DeSantis should be waging.
The problem is you're going to get to a place where people that are gay and conservative like myself, I can't defend it.
Randy Ross is a gay Republican who was Donald Trump's campaign chairman in 2016 here in Orange County. He wonders why Mr. DeSantis and Disney haven't dealt with their differences in private.
That is where you have this stumbling block of whether he's a good candidate. Because if he can't negotiate with Disney, how the hell is he going to negotiate with Russia or Ukraine or China?
Back at Disney, Steve Schussler is the owner-operator of multiple restaurants inside the parks. He took me for a ride in one of his amphibious cars he operates as a tourist attraction next to the Boathouse restaurant. As we toured around a lake surrounded by his restaurants, Mr. Schussler said Mr. DeSantis' fight is hurting the hundreds of staff he employs, as well as his businesses.
This is not a political conversation we're having. It's about him taking a stand in retaliation for Disney speaking out. That is absolutely insanity.
You hear from other business owners who are getting uneasy about this as well and feeling like they're kind of under the gun because of this feud?
Absolutely. First of all, they don't like the feud. But secondly, we're not politicians. We're business people. We're entrepreneurs. We've got our life on the line. We're just looking for peace, quiet, harmony, and not to be attacked.
Storms are not unusual in Florida, but an ominous crash of thunder and a pouring rain sent tourists scrambling for cover in nearby shops and restaurants around this well-manicured portion of Disney. As Ron DeSantis prepares to launch his presidential campaign, the Disney feud has been a metaphorical thunderclap of a political storm. But the governor seems to be betting that by taking a stand on cultural issues, even at the risk of angering a powerful corporation in his home state, he will win Republican votes in the presidential campaign to come. Time will tell whether this storm will pass, leaving Ron DeSantis' future looking bright.
That report by Anthony Zerker. Russia says it's now defeated insurgents who crossed the border from Ukraine to launch attacks in the Bielgorod region. Villages had been evacuated after coming under sustained shellfire. The Russian Defense Ministry claims to have killed 70 of the attackers while driving the rest back across the border. There's been no independent confirmation of this. Moscow continues to insist they were Ukrainians, but two Russian paramilitary groups have claimed responsibility, saying this was an attempt to overthrow Vladimir Putin's regime. With more, here's our Europe editor, Paul Moss.
Is it the start of an attempted revolution, Russian partisans trying to overthrow their own government, or are the attacks on Belgorod the opening salvo of Ukraine's counteroffensive? Either way, the Kremlin has conceded it's deeply concerned at what's happening. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, insists that Ukrainians are responsible, but he's now said they may be ethnic Russians. And that marks a major concession. Russia has always portrayed Russian speakers in Ukraine as loyal to Moscow. Now it seems to recognize they could be among Russia's enemies.
Paul Moss. It's a common problem. You send a message on WhatsApp only to regret it, either because you said something embarrassing or made a spelling mistake. But there's nothing you can do except delete the entire message. That's now about to change, as the messaging service has announced a new feature which will allow users to edit messages for up to 15 minutes after they were sent. The rollout is due to start within the next few weeks. The technology journalist Kate Bevan sees some problems ahead.
There are some concerns about transparency around editable messages. You don't know how somebody's changed something. Most of the time, that's probably not an issue. But if you've been responding to something in a group chat, for example, and then somebody retrospectively changes what they've said to make you look like an idiot, from what I can see, although you'll be able to see that a message has been edited, you won't be able to see the edit history.
But the Times journalist James Marriott thinks that the change, which has also happened on other platforms, is an important one.
It's a small change, but WhatsApp is such a huge feature of, you know, our entire lives that it has to matter. I think an interesting point is that we can easily forget how much of our politics is basically government by WhatsApp. Every single MP, every single minister, half their lives are spent in WhatsApp groups. It is true that WhatsApp's current means of dealing with a message that you send but wish you hadn't sent is that you have to delete it. And we may have all woken up to a string of messages from inebriated friends that just go, this message was deleted, this message was deleted, this message was deleted. And you kind of think, oh my God, what on earth happened? But I think editing is a slightly better way to deal with that. That speed of instant messaging apps like WhatsApp, and also I think like Twitter initially, which you can now also edit Twitter, that was a change that was brought in early this year. I think that sort of slightly ruthless speed of the early internet, those platforms are dialing back and realizing that, you know, what seemed attractive and fun at the beginning is actually quite a stressful part of interacting with those apps people now. And we would like to be able to edit our tweets. We would like to be able to edit our WhatsApps. And I think there are kind of a few breaks being applied to these, you know, slightly incredibly quick social media messaging services.
James Marriott. Still to come on this podcast.
Now I feel us pull apart.
A new play based on the groundbreaking film Brokeback Mountain has opened in London.
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, a new audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
The radiation is here. It's everywhere.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. here's a show that we recommend.
There's a twin mattress just laying on the floor. There's a video camera that is set up on a tripod. And then there's like a little lamp.
This is what we call a dungeon.
Hi, I'm Yardley Smith. Guess what? Season 12 of Small Town Dicks is here.
She says, I've never been more terrified in a room with a patient before as I am with this man here.
I say, if you keep me on based on what I saw out there at the crime scene, I'm going to turn into a defense witness.
The hair on the back of my neck was standing up.
Small Town Dicks Season 12 is out now. Don't miss it.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The use of vapes or e-cigarettes is banned in countries such as Argentina, Thailand and India and requires a prescription in other countries like Australia. In Britain, vapes can be sold to anyone over the age of 18, but this hasn't stopped younger people picking up the habit. An investigation by BBC News has found vapes confiscated from school pupils contained high levels of lead and other dangerous substances. Our reporter Harry Bly has been looking at the findings.
18 vapes were tested by a laboratory here in the UK. They received them from a school in England which had confiscated the vapes from students. To give you a visual, these are small, brightly coloured devices. They look a bit like highlighter pens. It's worth noting that most of the vapes that were tested were illegal and had not been registered with regulators in the UK. Here's what the lab tests found in the liquid of the vapes. That's the liquid that's burnt and inhaled by the user. Lead, a well-known toxic metal. More than twice the safe exposure level of lead was found. More than nine times the safe level of nickel metal was found. And over six times the safe level of chromium was found. Now, in addition to the metals, compounds called carbonyls, which break down into other harmful chemicals such as formaldehyde, were found as well. They're also found in cigarette smoke. In some of the vapes, more formaldehyde was found compared with cigarettes. David Lawson is the co-founder of Interscientific Laboratory, which carried out this study, and this is what he had to say on the findings.
We test products day in, day out. We have seized products from trading standards. We have products from manufacturers. And it's in 15 years of testing vape products, I don't think we've ever seen lead content like this in vape products.
Lead is a known toxic metal. It is a neurotoxin and can impair brain development. Chromium and nickel are allergens. And these metal particles in general, when found in the bloodstream, can trigger blood clotting and can exacerbate cardiovascular disease. The other chemicals I mentioned, carbonyls that were found, these are mildly carcinogenic, which means they can, in some cases, cause cancer. It's worth mentioning that these vapes were taken from school pupils. So here's some stats for you. In the UK, a survey from March suggests that 11.5% of 11 to 16-year-olds use vapes. In the USA, according to the FDA, 14% of high school students use vapes. In response to the findings, here in the UK, the Medicine and Healthcare Product Regulatory Agency said the results from the lab tests would be reviewed to assess whether the vapes posed a health risk to those using them.
Harry Bly. Many countries have trouble separating the actions of the Chinese state from those of Chinese companies. That's particularly acute when it comes to social media firms and concerns over national security. Many states in America have banned TikTok on government equipment, and last week Montana became the first state to ban the app from being downloaded there. Now the owners of the video sharing app have hit back. They're going to sue the state of Montana. Our US correspondent Peter Bose told my colleague Nick Miles why Montana's parliament had voted to ban the app.
TikTok are arguing in their lawsuit that banning a hugely popular social media app, as they see it, amounts to an illegal suppression of free speech tantamount to censorship. They claim to have 150 million users in the US, hundreds of thousands in Montana, and they say the new law unlawfully abridges one of the core freedoms guaranteed by the First Amendment of the US Constitution, the right to free speech. Now, on the issue of a possible national security threat, lawyers for TikTok argue that officials in Montana, state officials, are not even in a position to regulate on this, since foreign affairs and national security matters are federal issues to be determined at a national level. And it should also be noted that, as far as we're aware, there have been no cases of the Chinese government attempting to use TikTok as an espionage or data collection tool. And the TikTok lawsuit says Montana has enacted these extraordinary and unprecedented measures based on nothing more than unfounded speculation. And it adds that it believes the legal challenge will prevail based on an exceedingly strong set of precedents and facts.
So if it does prevail, what happens next?
Well, there's always the possibility that Montana could appeal and try to take this to a higher court. In fact, they're not surprised by this lawsuit. A spokeswoman for the state said, "We expected legal challenges and are fully prepared to defend the law." But it would be a significant victory for TikTok. It may serve to dampen down future talk of bans on the app, whether on a state or a national level. And of course, there is a lot of support from TikTok users, and perhaps more significantly, organizations here like the American Civil Liberties Union and digital rights advocacy groups. They argue that the Montana law does indeed impinge on Americans' rights to free speech. And that is a very powerful argument in the US courts.
Peter Bowes, the old adage that the customer is always right seems to have flown over the heads of some flight attendants on Cathay Pacific, Hong Kong's flagship airline. Several Chinese passengers reported that they were mocked because they only spoke Mandarin and that the cabin crew addressed them in English or Cantonese. The airline has apologised, but the bad feeling may linger among some of those affected. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, told us what happened.
There's been footage circulating today showing a flight that took place yesterday between Chengdu and Hong Kong. And you can hear somebody, presumably the air hostess, on the flight mocking a passenger asking for a carpet instead of a blanket. She says, "Carpet? Carpet is on the floor. If you can't say blanket in English, you cannot have it." And then you can hear her laughing with her colleagues. So this has been going viral, and it's led Cathay Pacific to issuing an apology and saying that it's going to carry out a full investigation. But for the time being, the staff who are on that flight have been suspended from flying.
And how shocking is this? Has anything like this happened before?
There have been many stories over the years of brands being criticised for hurting the feelings of the Chinese people. Actually, only last month, I was covering a story on how the car brand Mini was accused of discriminating mainland Chinese by giving ice cream only to foreign guests at a Shanghai auto show. But yes, I've seen many stories like this over the years. And what's common is that you'll see calls to boycott the brands. So in line with this, what I'm seeing a lot of today on social media platforms like Weibo, which is China's equivalent of Facebook or Twitter, is a lot of people saying, if you don't know how to treat Chinese people in the mainland, then you shouldn't be doing business with us.
In general, how do people in Hong Kong view other Chinese?
Well, I think there's a difficult relationship between the two. At the end of the day, people are people. So there are some people who feel very close to the mainland and vice versa. But there have been protests over the years in Hong Kong due to Beijing's increased restrictions in the city, the perceptions there. And again, I'm seeing a lot on social media platforms from people saying that, you know, that it's reigniting those feelings about tensions, particularly from mainlanders towards Hong Kongers. So a lot of comments about how some social media users perceive Hong Kongers as troublemakers and cockroaches. And so they do feel that this airline shouldn't have a market within mainland China.
Kerry Allen. The disgraced former entertainer and convicted sex offender Rolf Harris has died. He was 93. Harris was jailed for nearly 6 years here in the UK for a series of indecent assaults on girls. Before his offences came to light, Harris was a well-known figure in the entertainment industry here in Britain and in his native Australia. Helena Wilkinson reports.
Rolf Harris was for decades a regular fixture on television in Britain. He enjoyed success with a series of novelty songs and presented a range of shows, including Rolf's Cartoon Time and Animal Hospital.
G'day. Welcome back to the Harmsworth Hospital in North London.
But he exploited his fame to mask his offending. In 2014, he was convicted of 12 indecent assaults, relating to four girls between 1968 and 1986 and jailed for 5 years and 9 months. 3 years later, the Court of Appeal overturned one of the convictions as the judge ruled it was unsafe. His conviction came after Jimmy Savile was unmasked as a prolific sex offender. The scandal emboldened the women that Harris indecently assaulted to come forward. At his sentencing hearing, the judge said that Harris had shown no remorse and used his celebrity status to take advantage of his victims.
Helena Wilkinson. Now, this next story broke new ground and challenged social conventions on film in 2005. Brokeback Mountain is about a love affair between two cowboys in 1960s Wyoming and Texas. Since then, it's been turned into an opera, and now it's just opened in London as a stage play with country music. Our arts reporter, Vincent Dowd, has been to see it and spoke to my colleague, Nick Miles.
Things might be a bit different today, of course. 18 years ago, yes, it was 18 years ago, it was seen as very unusual, maybe brave, for two of the biggest young actors of that time, Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger, of course, is no longer with us, sadly, would play roles of two gay cowboys in a story which at least starts in early 1960s Wyoming. Maybe almost two decades on, it would be much less remarkable. Of course, Larry McMurtry's script was really, really smart, and it's still one of Ang Lee's best movies. I would say possibly still his best movie, to be honest. It made Wyoming look fantastic, even if in reality the film was mainly shot in Canada.
So how did this get onto stage, and how much of a difficulty was that?
It's very interesting. I think only a theatre like the Soho Place, which is a very new theatre here in the round in London, it's having a lot of success already, would have the courage maybe to do it. Obviously, it can't do American wide-open landscapes or any landscapes, but the poetry, I would say, comes from a very bright idea of having new country-flavoured songs. We should say it's not a musical, which early on one or two people were saying, oh, it's a musical. The characters on stage don't sing, but Dan Gillespie-Sells has written really good songs for The Balladeer, which comment on the action, and they're sung really well by Eddie Reader. Us pull apart, 'cause I'm not
alone in sharing your heart. It seems strange to me that this production is coming out in London rather than in New York. It's likely to go there, you'd imagine?
Yeah, it couldn't be a more American story, could it? Two young American actors, not exactly megastars, but very much in demand, an American adapter. It's interesting that the musicians basically are American. Yes, the producers will want this to go to Broadway or maybe to off-Broadway. A project like this is much, much cheaper to develop here than it would be in New York City. So, is it good enough to go? I asked the people who were leaving the theatre last night.
The pace of it was a little bit rushed. They've got to get 20 years in about an hour and a half.
Yeah, I thought it was a great play, very intimate. Yeah, quite true to the movie and the book, so really enjoyed it.
I wasn't old enough to see the film in theatres, but I was old enough to educate myself on it later, being a member of the LGBTQ community myself. This adaptation completely took away the fear that I had that some of the performances would be, like, echoing it, that Lucas Hedges is doing exactly what Heath Ledger is doing. That was not that fear was completely assuaged once I saw it. They were completely doing their own takes on it.
And it was, like, refreshing, a fantastic night of theatre.
So that's their assessment. What's your assessment? A hit?
Yes, the play isn't perfect, but I enjoyed it, if I'm honest, Nick, more than I was expecting to. Maybe there's a bit of work which needs to be done on the structure here and there, but the music is lovely, the core performances are great, and I would say, yes, audiences will really love this play.
That was Vincent Dowd talking about Brokeback Mountain, the play which has opened here in London. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Kouzaris. The producer was Alice Adley. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
There's a twin mattress just laying on the floor. There's a video camera that is set up on a tripod. And then there's like a little lamp.
This is what we call a dungeon.
Hi, I'm Yardley Smith. Guess what? Season 12 of Small Town Dicks is here.
She says, I've never been more terrified in a room with a patient before as I am with this man here.
I say, if you keep me on based on what I saw out there at the crime scene, I'm going to turn into a defense witness.
The hair on the back of my neck was standing up.
Small Town Dicks Season 12 is out now. Don't miss it.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.